Chapter 9. The Core. Meanwhile, I was in a place of clouds. Big, puffy, pink-white ones that showed up sharply against the deep blue-black sky. Higher than the clouds, immeasurably higher. Flocks of transparent orbs, shimmering beings, arced across the sky, leaving long, streamer-like lines behind them. Birds? Angels? These words registered when I was writing down my recollections. But neither of these words do justice to the beings themselves, which were quite simply different from anything I have known on this planet. They were more advanced. Higher. A sound, huge and booming, like a glorious chant, came down from above, and I wondered if the winged beings were producing it. Again, thinking about it later, it occurred to me that the joy of these creatures as they soared along was such that they had to make this noise. That if the joy didn't come out of them this way, then they would simply not otherwise be able to contain it. The sound was palpable and almost material, like a rain that you can feel on your skin but that doesn't get you wet. Seeing and hearing were not separate in this place where I now was. I could hear the visual beauty of the silvery bodies of those scintillating beings above, and I could see the surging, joyful perfection of what they sang. It seemed that you could not look at or listen to anything in this world without becoming a part of it, without joining with it in some mysterious way. Again, from my present perspective, I would suggest that you couldn't look at anything in that world at all, for the word at itself implies a separation that did not exist there. Everything was distinct, yet everything was also a part of everything else, like the rich and intermingled designs on a Persian carpet or a butterfly's wing. A warm wind blew through, like the kind that spring up on the most perfect summer days, tossing the leaves of the trees and flowing past like heavenly water. A divine breeze. It changed everything, shifting the world around me into an even higher octave, a higher vibration. Although I still had very little language function, at least as we think of it on Earth, I began wordlessly putting questions to this wind and to the divine being that I sensed at work behind or within it. Where is this place? Who am I? Why am I here? Each time I silently posed one of these questions, the answer came instantly in an explosion of light, color, love, and beauty that blew through me like a crashing wave. What was important about these bursts was that they didn't simply silence my questions by overwhelming them. They answered them, but in a way that bypassed language. Thoughts entered me directly, but it wasn't thought like we experience on Earth. It wasn't vague, immaterial, or abstract. These thoughts were solid and immediate, hotter than fire and wetter than water, and as I received them, I was able to instantly and effortlessly understand concepts that would have taken me years to fully grasp in my earthly life. I continued moving forward and found myself entering an immense void, completely dark, infinite in size, yet also infinitely comforting. Pitch black as it was also brimming over with light, a light that seemed to come from a brilliant orb that I now sensed near me, an orb that was living and almost solid, as the songs of the angel beings had been. My situation was, strangely enough, something akin to that of a fetus in a womb. The fetus floats in the womb with a silent partner of the placenta, which nourishes it and mediates its relationship to the everywhere present yet at the same time invisible mother. In this case, the mother was God, the creator, the source, who was responsible for making the universe and all in it. This being was so close that there seemed to be no distance at all between God and myself. Yet at the same time, I could sense the infinite vastness of the creator, could see how completely minuscule I was by comparison. I will occasionally use Om as the pronoun for God, because I originally used that name in my original writings after my coma. Om was the sound I remembered hearing associated with that omniscient, omnipotent, and unconditionally loving God, but any descriptive word falls short. The pure vastness separating Om and me was, I realized, why I had the orb as my companion. In some manner, I couldn't completely comprehend, but was sure of nonetheless. The orb was a kind of interpreter between me and this extraordinary presence surrounding me. It was as if I were being born into a larger world, and the universe itself was like a giant cosmic womb. And the orb, who remained in some way connected to the girl on the butterfly wing, who in fact was she, was guiding me through this process. Later, when I was back here in the world, I found a quotation by the 17th century Christian poet Henry Vaughan that came close to describing this place, this vast, inky black core that was the home of the divine itself. There is, some say, in God a deep but dazzling darkness. That was it, exactly. An inky darkness that was also full to brimming with light. The questions and the answers continued. Though they still didn't come in the form of language as we know it, the voice of this being was warm and, odd as I know this may sound, personal. It understood humans, and it possessed the qualities we possess, only in infinitely greater measure. It knew me deeply and overflowed with qualities that all my life I've always associated with human beings, and human beings alone. Warmth, compassion, pathos, even irony and humor. Through the orb, Om told me that there is not one universe but many. In fact, more than I could conceive. But that love lay at the center of them all. Evil was present in all the other universes as well, but only in the tiniest trace amounts. Evil was necessary because without it, free will was impossible. And without free will, there could be no growth, no forward movement. No chance for us to become what God longed for us to be. Horrible and all-powerful as evil sometimes seemed to be in a world like ours, in the larger picture, love was overwhelmingly dominant, and it would ultimately be triumphant. I saw the abundance of light throughout the countless universes, including some whose intelligence was advanced far beyond that of humanity. I saw that there are countless higher dimensions, but that the only way to know these dimensions is to enter and experience them directly. They cannot be known or understood from lower dimensional space. Cause and effect exist in these higher realms, but outside of our earthly conception of them. The world of time and space in which we move in this terrestrial realm is tightly and intricately meshed within these higher worlds. In other words, these worlds aren't totally apart from us because all worlds are part of the same overarching divine reality. From those higher worlds, one could access any time or place in our world. It will take me the rest of my life and then some to unpack what I learned up there. The knowledge given me was not taught in the way that a history lesson or math theorem would be. Insights happen directly, rather than needing to be coaxed and absorbed. Knowledge was stored without memorization, instantly and for good. It didn't fade like ordinary information does. And to this day, I still possess all of it, much more clearly than I possess the information that I gained over all my years in school. That's not to say that I can get to this knowledge just like that. Because now that I'm back here in the earthly realm, I have to process it through my limited physical body and brain. But it's there. I feel it, laid into my very being. For a person like me who had spent his whole life working hard to accumulate knowledge and understanding the old-fashioned way, the discovery of this more advanced level of learning was, alone, enough to give me food for thought for ages to come. Unfortunately, for my family and my doctors back on Earth, the situation was very different. Chapter 10. What Counts? Holly didn't fail to notice how interested the doctors became when she mentioned my trip to Israel. Of course, she didn't understand why it was so important. In retrospect, it was a blessing that she didn't. Coping with my possible death was burden enough. Chapter 12, The Core. Something pulled at me. Not like someone grabbing my arm, but something subtler, less physical. It was a little like when the sun dips behind a cloud, and you feel your mood change instantly in response. I was going back, away from the core. Its inky, bright darkness faded into the green landscape of the gateway, with all of its dazzling landscape. Looking down, I saw the villagers again, the trees and sparkling streams and the waterfalls, as well as the arcing angel beings above. My companion was there, too. She had been there the whole time, of course, all through my journey into the core, in the form of that orb-like ball of light. But now she was, once again, in human form. She wore the same beautiful dress, and seeing her again made me feel like a child lost in a huge and alien city, who suddenly comes upon a familiar face. What a gift she was! We will show you many things, but you will be going back. That message, delivered wordlessly to me at the entrance to the trackless darkness of the core, came back to me now. I also now understood where back was. The realm of the earthworm's eye view, where I had started this odyssey. But it was different this time. Moving down into the darkness with a full knowledge of what lay above it, I no longer experienced the trepidation that I had when I was originally there. As the glorious music of the gateway faded out, and the pulse-like pounding of the lower realm returned, I heard and saw these things as an adult sees a place where he or she had once been frightened, but is no longer afraid. The murk and darkness, the faces that bubbled up and faded away, the artery-like roots that came down from above, held no terror for me now, because I understood, in the wordless way, I understood everything then, that I was no longer of this place, but only visiting it. But why was I visiting it again? The answer came to me in the same instantaneous, nonverbal way that the answers in the brilliant world above had been delivered. This whole adventure, it began to occur to me, was some kind of tour, some kind of grand overview of the invisible spiritual side of existence. And like all good tours, it included all floors and all levels. Once I was back in the lower realm, the vagaries of time in these worlds beyond what I knew of this earth continued to hold. To get a little, if only a very little, idea of what this feels like, ponder how time lays itself out in dreams. In a dream, before and after become tricky designations. You can be in one part of the dream and know what's coming, even if you haven't experienced it yet. My time out beyond was something like that. Though I should also underline that what happened to me had none of the murky confusion of our earthbound dreams, except at the very earliest stages when I was still in the underworld. How long was I there this time? Again, I have no real idea, no way to gauge it. But I do know that after returning to the lower realm, it took a long time to discover that I actually had some control over my course, that I was no longer trapped in this lower world. With concerted effort, I could move back up to the higher planes. At a certain point in the murky depths, I found myself wishing for the spinning melody to return. After an initial struggle to recall the notes, the gorgeous music, and the spinning ball of light emitting it blossomed into my awareness. They cut once again through the jellied muck, and I began to rise. In the worlds above, I slowly discovered, to know and be able to think of something is all one needs in order to move toward it. To think of the spinning melody was to make it appear, and to long for the higher worlds was to bring myself there. The more familiar I became with the world above, the easier it was to return to it. During my time out of my body, I accomplished this back-and-forth movement from the muddy darkness of the realm of the earthworm's eye view to the green brilliance of the gateway, and into the black but holy darkness of the core, any number of times. How many I can't say exactly. Again, because time as it was there just doesn't translate to our conception of time here on Earth. But each time I reached the core, I went deeper than before, and was taught more in the wordless, more than verbal way that all things were communicated in the worlds above this one. That doesn't mean that I saw anything like the whole universe, either in my original journey from the earthworm's eye view up to the core, or in the ones that came afterward. In fact, one of the truths driven home to me in the core each time I returned to it was how impossible it would be to understand all that exists, either its physical, visible side or its much, much larger, spiritual, invisible side. Not to mention the countless other universes that exist or have ever existed. But none of that mattered because I had already been taught the one thing, the only thing, that in the last analysis truly matters. I had initially received this piece of knowledge from my lovely companion on the butterfly wing upon my first entrance into the gateway. It came in three parts, and to take one more shot at putting it into words, because, of course, it was initially delivered wordlessly, it would run something like this. You are loved and cherished. You have nothing to fear. There is nothing you can do wrong. If I had to boil this entire message down to one sentence, it would run this way. You are loved. And if I had to boil it down further to just one word, it would, of course, be simply love. Love is, without a doubt, the basis of everything. Not some abstract, hard-to-fathom kind of love, but the day-to-day kind that everyone knows. The kind of love we feel when we look at our spouse and our children, or even our animals. In its purest and most powerful form, this love is not jealous or selfish, but unconditional. This is the reality of realities, the incomprehensibly glorious truth of truths that lives and breathes at the core of everything that exists or that ever will exist, and no remotely accurate understanding of who and what we are can be achieved by anyone who does not know it and embody it in all of their actions. Not much of a scientific insight? Well, I beg to differ. I'm back from that place, and nothing could convince me that this is not only the single most important emotional truth in the universe, but also the single most important scientific truth as well. I've been talking about my experience, as well as meeting other people who study or have undergone near-death experiences, for several years now. I know that the term unconditional love gets bandied around a lot in those circles. How many of us can grasp what that truly means? I know, of course, why the term comes up as much as it does. It's because many, many other people have seen and experienced what I did. But like me, when these people come back to the earthly level, they're stuck with words, and words alone, to convey experiences and insights that lie completely beyond the power of words. It's like trying to write a novel with only half the alphabet. The primary hurdle that most NDE subjects must jump is not how to reacclimate to the limitations of the earthly world, though this can certainly be a challenge, but how to convey what the love they experienced out there actually feels like. Deep down, we already know. Just as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz always had the capability to return home, we have the ability to recover our connection with that idyllic realm. We just forget that we do, because during the brain-based, physical portion of our existence, our brain blocks out or veils that larger cosmic background, just as the sun's light blocks the stars from view each morning. Imagine how limited our view of the universe would be if we never saw the star-spangled nighttime sky. We can only see what our brain's filter allows through. The brain, in particular its left-side linguistic logical part, that which generates our sense of rationality and the feeling of being a sharply defined ego or self, is a barrier to our higher knowledge and experience. It is my belief that we are now facing a crucial time in our existence. We need to recover more of that larger knowledge while living here on Earth, while our brains, including its left-side analytical parts, are fully functioning. Science, the science to which I've devoted so much of my life, doesn't contradict what I learned up there. But far, far too many people believe it does, because certain members of the scientific community, who are pledged to the materialist worldview, have insisted again and again that science and spirituality cannot coexist. They are mistaken. Making this ancient but ultimately basic fact more widely known is why I have written this book, and it renders all the other aspects of my story, the mystery of how I contracted my illness, of how I managed to be conscious in another dimension for the week of my coma, and how I somehow recovered so completely, entirely secondary. The unconditional love and acceptance that I experienced on my journey is the single most important discovery I have ever made or will ever make, and as hard as I know it's going to be to unpack the other lessons I learned while there, I also know in my heart that sharing this very basic message, one so simple that most children readily accept it, is the most important task I have. Chapter 13, Wednesday. For 2 days, Wednesday had been the buzzword, the day on my doctor's lips when it came to describing my chances. As in, we hope to see some improvement by Wednesday. And now here Wednesday was, without so much as a glimmer of change in my condition. To use the word removed makes it sound as if the absence of my earthly memories while in the realm of the earthworm's eye view, the gateway, and the core, was in some manner intentional. I now suspect that this was the case. At the risk of oversimplifying, I was allowed to die harder and travel deeper than almost all NDE subjects before me. As arrogant as that might sound, my intentions are not. The rich literature on NDEs has proved crucial to understanding my own journey in coma. I can't claim to know why I had the experience I had, but I do know now, 3 years later, from reading other NDE literature, that the penetration of the higher worlds tends to be a gradual process and requires that the individual release his or her attachments to whatever level he or she is on before going higher or deeper. That was not a problem for me, because throughout my experience I had no earthly memories whatsoever, and the only pain and heartache I felt was when I had to return to Earth, where I had begun. Chapter 15, The Gift of Forgetting. We must believe in free will. We have no choice. Isaac B. Singer, 1902 to 1991. The view of human consciousness held by most scientists today is that it is composed of digital information, data, that is, of essentially the same kind used by computers. Though some bits of this data, seeing a spectacular sunset, hearing a beautiful symphony for the first time, even falling in love, may feel more profound or special to us than the countless other bits of information created and stored in our brains, this is really just an illusion. All bits are, in fact, qualitatively the same. Our brains model outside reality by taking the information that comes in through our senses and transforming it into a rich digital tapestry. But our perceptions are just a model, not reality itself. An illusion. This was, of course, the view I held as well. I can remember being in medical school and occasionally hearing arguments that consciousness is nothing more than a very complex computer program. These arguments suggested that the 10 billion or so neurons firing constantly within our brains are capable of producing a lifetime of consciousness and memory. To understand how the brain might actually block our access to knowledge of the higher worlds, we need to accept, at least hypothetically and for the moment, that the brain itself doesn't produce consciousness. That it is, instead, a kind of reducing valve or filter, shifting the larger non-physical consciousness that we possess in the non-physical worlds down into a more limited capacity for the duration of our mortal lives. There is, from the earthly perspective, a very definite advantage to this. Just as our brains work hard every moment of our waking lives to filter out the barrage of sensory information coming at us from our physical surroundings, selecting the material we actually need in order to survive, so it is that forgetting our trans-earthly identities also allows us to be here and now far more effectively. Just as most of ordinary life holds too much information for us to take in at once and still get anything done, being excessively conscious of the worlds beyond the here and now would slow down our progress even more. If we knew too much of the spiritual realm now, then navigating our lives on Earth would be an even greater challenge than it already is. That's not to say we shouldn't be conscious of the worlds beyond now, only that if we are extra conscious of their grandeur and immensity, they can prevent action while still here on Earth. From a more purpose-focused perspective, and I now believe the universe is nothing if not purposeful, making the right decisions through our free will in the face of the evil and injustice on Earth would mean far less if we remembered, while here, the full beauty and brilliance of what awaits us. Why am I so sure of all this? For two reasons. The first is that I was shown it by the beings who taught me when I was in the gateway and the core, and the second is because I actually experienced it. While beyond my body, I received knowledge about the nature and structure of the universe that was vastly beyond my comprehension. But I received it anyhow, in large part because, with my worldly preoccupations out of the way, I had room to do so. Now that I'm back on Earth and remember my bodily identity, the seed of that trans-earthly knowledge has once again been covered over. And yet it's still there. I can feel it at every moment. It will take years in this earthly environment to come to fruition. That is, it will take me years to understand, using my mortal, material brain, what I understood so instantly and easily in the brain-free realms of the world beyond. Yet I'm confident that with hard work on my part, much of that knowledge will continue to unfold. To say that there is still a chasm between our current scientific understanding of the universe and the truth as I saw it is a considerable understatement. I still love physics and cosmology, still love studying our vast and wonderful universe. Only I now have a greatly enlarged conception of what vast and wonderful really mean. The physical side of the universe is as a speck of dust compared to the invisible and spiritual part. In my past view, spiritual wasn't a word that I would have employed during a scientific conversation. Now I believe it is a word that we cannot afford to leave out. From the core, my understanding of what we call dark energy and dark matter seemed to have clear explanations, as did far more advanced components of the makeup of our universe that humans won't address for ages. This doesn't mean, however, that I can explain them to you. That's because, paradoxically, I am still in the process of understanding them myself. Perhaps the best way of conveying that part of the experience is to say that I had a foretaste of another, larger kind of knowledge, one I believe human beings will be able to access in even larger numbers in the future. But conveying that knowledge now is rather like being a chimpanzee, becoming a human for a single day to experience all of the wonders of human knowledge, and then returning to one's chimp friends and trying to tell them what it was like, knowing several different romance languages, the calculus, and the immense scale of the universe. Up there, a question would arise in my mind, and the answer would arise at the same time, like a flower coming up right next to it. It was almost as if, just as no physical particle in the universe is really separate from another, so in the same way there was no such thing as a question without an accompanying answer. These answers were not simple yes or no fare either. They were vast conceptual edifices, staggering structures of living thought as intricate as cities. Ideas so vast they would have taken me lifetimes to find my way around if I had been confined to earthly thought. But I wasn't. I had sloughed off that earthly style of thought like a butterfly breaking from a chrysalis. I saw the Earth as a pale blue dot in the immense blackness of physical space. I could see that Earth was a place where good and evil mixed, and that this constituted one of its unique features. Even on Earth, there is much more good than evil, but Earth is a place where evil is allowed to gain influence in a way that would be entirely impossible at higher levels of existence. That evil could occasionally have the upper hand was known and allowed by the Creator as a necessary consequence of giving the gift of free will to beings like us. Small particles of evil were scattered throughout the universe, but the sum total of all that evil was as a grain of sand on a vast beach compared to the goodness, abundance, hope, and unconditional love in which the universe was literally awash. The very fabric of the alternate dimension is love and acceptance, and anything that does not have these qualities appears immediately and obviously out of place there. But free will comes at the cost of a loss or falling away from this love and acceptance. We are free, but we are free beings hemmed all around by an environment conspiring to make us feel that we are not free. Free will is of central importance for our function in the earthly realm, a function that, we will all one day discover, serves the much higher role of allowing our ascendance in the timeless alternate dimension. Our life down here may seem insignificant, for it is minute in relation to the other lives and other worlds that also crowd the invisible and visible universes. But it is also hugely important, for our role here is to grow toward the divine, and that growth is closely watched by the beings in the worlds above, the souls and lucent orbs, those beings I saw originally far above me in the gateway, and which I believe are the origin of our culture's concept of angels. We, the spiritual beings currently inhabiting our evolutionarily developed mortal brains and bodies, the product of the earth and the exigencies of the earth, make the real choices. True thought is not the brain's affair. But we have, in part by the brain itself, been so trained to associate our brains with what we think and who we are that we have lost the ability to realize that we are at all times much more than the physical brains and bodies that do, or should do, our bidding. True thought is pre-physical. This is the thinking behind the thinking responsible for all the genuinely consequential choices we make in the world. A thinking that is not dependent on linear deduction, but that moves fast as lightning, making connections on different levels, bringing them together. In the face of this free inner intelligence, our ordinary thought is hopelessly slow and fumbling. It's this thinking that catches the football in the end zone, that comes up with the inspired scientific insight, or writes the inspired song. The subliminal thinking that is always there when we really need it, but that we have all too often lost the ability both to access and to believe in. I feel we should do everything in our power to get in touch with this miraculous aspect of ourselves, to cultivate it and bring it to light. This is the being living within all of us right now, and that is, in fact, the being that God truly intends us to be. How do we get closer to this genuine spiritual self? By manifesting love and compassion. Why? Because love and compassion are far more than the abstractions many of us believe them to be. They are real, they are concrete, and they make up the very fabric of the spiritual realm. In order to return to that realm, we must once again become like that realm, even while we are stuck in and plodding through this one. One of the biggest mistakes people make when they think about God is to imagine God as impersonal. Yes, God is behind the numbers, the perfection of the universe that science measures and struggles to understand. But again, paradoxically, Om is human as well, even more human than you and I are. Om understands and sympathizes with our human situation more profoundly and personally than we can even imagine, because Om knows what we have forgotten and understands the terrible burden it is to live with amnesia of the divine for even a moment. Chapter 16, The Well. Holly first met our friend Sylvia in the 1980s. When both were teaching at the Ravenscroft School in Raleigh, North Carolina. While there, Holly was also a close friend of Susan Wrench's. Susan is an intuitive, a fact that never got in the way of my feelings about her. She was, to my mind, a very special person, even if what she did was...